Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. Now I'll turn the meeting over to Department of Education. You may begin.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Heidi Silver-Pakula. I'm in the Department of Education Office of Career Technical and Adult Education. Welcome to the webinar, Education, a Key Service in WIOA. We're glad to see so many people here with us today. We are brought together by the unhappy coincidence of Snowzilla back in January. We had to cancel a panel at the early part of that convening, and this was that panel. And so we knew that we wanted to offer it and look for a way to get this information out to folks. So we're glad to welcome participants from the convening that happened in D.C. in January. We had a full house despite the weather. That was just terrific. And we're welcome to all of those who were not able to join us at the convening but can join us for the webinar. So that's a nice way to have some new people join us. I want to let you know before we begin that this telephone call and webinar are being recorded, as was mentioned, and we'll have transcripts up in a few days. We will also be sending you the links to all the resources that are shared, and that will come in an email as you leave the webinar in the thank you email, and we'll put them up in the chat as well. The slides are not here in WebEx to download, but we'll be making them 508 compliant and get them up where you can download them from the web as well. So with that, those logistics points, all of you are in mute mode and will be throughout the webinar. If you have questions that you'd like to ask of the panelists, you may put them into the chat box or into the Q&A, and we will be monitoring those for the Q&A session at the end. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Mitsui.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to participate in today's webinar. And I'd like to open the panel by providing each of the panelists an opportunity to further introduce themselves with a little more detail and also to provide their vision of the opportunities that WIOA represents for stakeholders. And first up amongst our panel will be the Assistant Secretary from the Department of Labor, Portia Wu.
Thanks, Mark. Delighted to be here with everybody today. There are some really tremendous opportunities we have here under the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, and just the group of people together on the call today really, I think, represents the tremendous partnership we've established at the federal level, and this opportunity for partnership across programs at every level in government. It's really all of our job, and we want to work together to create more streamlined, integrated approaches to serve our common customers, and that's job seekers, workers, as business and businesses as well. WIOA gives us lots of great opportunities to do this through planning, governance, performance management, sharing of information. And I think that one of the very exciting things for us at the Department of Labor is the emphasis the law puts on our service delivery system, the American Job Centers. So, you know, as Secretary Perez often says, when people come in the door, they don't think about whether they have an adult ed or a VR or a youth formula program problem or challenge. They just have a bunch of challenges, and what they're looking for when they come into our centers is to have a positive experience, and we want to have a shared sense of responsibility as well as accomplishment among all our programs for meeting our customers' needs, helping them overcome hurdles and get on the path to great jobs in the middle class. So helping our customers do that and supporting their families and achieving their full potential is really part of all of our shared work. That's what we're all about, and I'm glad to be in this wonderful partnership with all of you doing it together.
Great. Thank you, Portia. Our next panelist is Michael Uden, Assistant Secretary here at the Department of Education.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Portia, for joining us and my colleagues and everybody that's
joined us today. Really excited about the opportunities that we have before us in WIOA. When the president signed the bill into law, he really created this incredible opportunity to provide for workers, for job seekers, for individuals with barriers to employment, a comprehensive, high quality education and workforce development system that really can meet the demands of not only workers but of the local economy as well. Really believe this is a very important opportunity, the field is ripe for great things to come. I just want to spend a minute or two talking about individuals with disabilities, there are about 37.5 million individuals with disabilities in this country. That's about 12% of the population. The stats, however, around people with disabilities are really pretty shocking and unacceptable, I think, to all of us. For example, we know that about 60% of individuals with disabilities 25 years or older have a high school diploma or less. So keep that in mind as we think about the education and the workforce development training system. We know that individuals with disabilities, only about 20% are participating in the labor force today. I'll repeat that. Only about 20% of individuals with disabilities are participating in the labor force out of 37.6 million individuals with disabilities. For those that are participating without a high school diploma is only 9.3%. For those individuals that have high school but no college, that number is only a little better at 17.2%. We know that individuals with disabilities are overrepresented in service jobs and production jobs. They're underrepresented in management, professional, and technology jobs. So when we think about individuals with disabilities, we sometimes just automatically go to the VR program, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, and it's an incredibly important program, but it is only designed to serve about 1 million individuals with disabilities a year. And the focus of the program is really on those with significant disabilities and, in fact, a priority for those with the most significant disabilities. So, again, we're talking about a program that serves about 1 million individuals with disabilities a year. There are about 37.5 million individuals with disabilities in this country, and only 20% of them are participating in the labor force. So we have this incredible opportunity for this renovated and improved federal workforce development system that can really provide the additional educational and training needs for individuals with disabilities in a much more comprehensive and robust way. We're really talking about a high quality, seamless, as Portia said, seamless. When a person comes into the one-stop system, they're not thinking about a particular program. They're looking for a job. They're looking for a particular set of training or educational programs. So we really have the opportunity to create this high-quality, accessible workforce development system, and it's critical, but it's a great opportunity. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mark.
Thank you, Michael. Next, my pleasure to introduce Janet Labreck, Commissioner of Rehabilitation Services Administration here at the Department of Education.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here today, and we are too excited to be a part of this partnership. And the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, as you just heard Michael reference, about 1 million individuals annually who apply for services through the Vocational Rehabilitation Program each year, I think really gives us this opportunity under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act to really leverage these partnerships in a way that allows us to have a universal approach as well as valuing the uniqueness and the expertise in leveraging the existing resources that we are all coming together to support the disability community and the job seekers in our country to really promote, I think, innovation and opportunity in a way that is going to lead to success for all of the populations that we serve. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Janet. It's now my pleasure to introduce another panelist, Johan Uven, Acting Assistant Secretary for the Office of Career Technical and Adult Education in the Department of Education. Johan.
Thank you, Mark, and good afternoon to most of you, and I think for a few of you, still good morning for another 5 minutes or so on the West Coast. So, know, when talking about vision, I think it's good to talk a little bit about who the vision is for, you know, the youth, the adults, and the employers that are part or the target of this new law. And when I think about the populations, we know that there is an enormous need and unmet demand for education, training, labor exchange, and support services. Just to give a couple of examples, there are 36 million low-skilled adults in our country who lack the foundation skills to get ahead. There are 5.5 million disconnected youth. Michael mentioned there are 37.6 million individuals with disabilities. Every year, 700,000 people return from our prisons and jails and into our community. So when we think about these numbers, it's not hard to envision that our vision should be about restoring opportunity or creating a second chance for many of these populations, or even perhaps create opportunity or a first chance for these millions of youths and adults. So this I think, results in two important ways of looking at the opportunity that the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act represents from an education perspective. The first real opportunity is that we can maximize the potential of the core and partner programs so that we can provide services more holistically and efficiently. Because we should admit to this that none of the programs alone, and that includes the core programs and the partner programs as well, we can actually do this by ourselves. We actually need this level of collaboration. But even if we do this, it only gets us half of the way there. So, and the second important way of looking at the opportunity that WIOA represents has to do with leveraging, using the WIOA provisions, leveraging what I call our bigger systems. By that I mean the employer community, the labor management community, other systems that are out there. And I'd like to just highlight, using the employer community, what leveraging bigger systems really means. Some research became available a couple of months ago that showed that employers in our country collectively invest over $413 billion in formal training of employees. Now, that is a set of resources, that is an existing ecosystem out there that we are not currently leveraging in ways that we could. And I believe sort of illustrates this second big opportunity. So if we implement this vision, then I think we will be able to restore or create opportunity for all, not just some Americans, so that they can develop the skills and get the credentials that will get them to a good, well-paying job and ultimately a path into the middle class. Mark?
Thank you, Johan. And thanks to all of you for those inspiring visions of a WIOA fully implemented. I know our listeners are probably still deep in the work of getting the pillars of implementation in place. So it's good to have your vision and idea of the structure that you are all building as a framework for the work that folks are doing each and every day. I'd like to offer just a few thoughts on the role of community colleges in WIOA. For example, the opportunities for community colleges to be eligible training providers and also to compete and to apply for becoming one-stops. Those are unique opportunities for this sector. And the use of common performance metrics, I think, is very key and fundamental in terms of applying metrics across all the core titles that now create a stake in the success of each title and their programs in another title in its programs. So there's now not only common performance metrics, but sort of a common stake in success for each of the different types of programs. In addition to that, the community colleges, I know, are embedded in the process of developing unified state plans as well as, in some cases, combined state plans. And finally, there are some new funding thresholds and areas for opportunity youth, corrections, and other sectors. So that's an area for the community colleges to explore as well. But taking a look at those different types of developments and also the related vision, all of these describe our customers in the WHEEL system, job seekers, students, new citizens, as advancing along a career pathway toward greater self-sufficiency. The title of our panel and the main point of our remarks today is that education is a key service. It's critical to success in the labor market and to earning a family-supporting wage. But to give us some hard realities about this point, Michael, would you like to give us some context as to why education is so critical to success in WHEELA?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. So as folks may know, during his last State of the Union address to the country, President Obama said that the United States right now has the strongest, most durable economy in the world. We're in the middle of the longest streak of private sector job creation in history. Yet, as we know, as Secretary Perez talked about at the WHEOA convening, we know that millions of jobs actually go unfilled due to a lack of a skilled workforce. We really have a great opportunity here now. As everybody knows, you know, Congress passed in bipartisan fashion, bicameral fashion, the most significant reform of the federal adult education workforce development system in well over a decade. What a great opportunity this is. Again, presents this opportunity to change the way our systems operate. So through WHEOA, we really do look forward to streamlining the way we do our business in order to shape the nation's employment and training systems into one that actually provides improved outcomes for all job seekers, for workers, employers, but particularly for those with barriers to employment. The new law supports innovative strategies to keep pace with changing economic conditions, providing expanding education, training, and employment opportunities for the millions of youth and adults that are served annually by our systems. So, you know, we all talk about our programs needing to prepare students to be college and career ready. And when we think about that, what we mean is really ensuring that we're meeting the demands of our local and regional economies, that, you know, we're talking about job-driven training, that we're meeting the demands of our workers. But in order to do that, you know, our workforce development system, our providers need to have a good understanding of the market conditions to really prepare our workforce with the skills to meet that kind of demand. So right now I want to take a minute and share some slides and infographics with you to help kind of tell the story about America's skills gap and the role that education can play in closing it. So according to the Manufacturing Institute and Deloitte, of the nearly 3.5 million manufacturing jobs that will be needed over the next decade, 2 million will go unfilled. It's largely due to the baby boomer retirements. The same report states that executives in the manufacturing field consider technical and computer skills to be the most serious skill deficiencies, followed by problem-solving skills, basic technical training, and math. Together with our partners at the Departments of Labor, Department of Health and Human Services, and the continued efforts and commitment of states and local providers performing the work on the front lines, we can make a difference for those individuals who do have the greatest barriers to employment by offering them enhanced access and clear pathways to stable careers with family-sustaining wages. We recognize that skills and post-secondary education and training program completion makes a difference. In fact, if you look at this slide, you'll see that it demonstrates that those adults with only a high school diploma or less suffered more and recovered less from the Great Recession. Essentially, the Great Recovery is leaving them behind. This next slide from a recent ETS report shows similar patterns of unemployment side by side with median weekly earnings in 2014. And again, those without a college degree are stuck with much higher unemployment and lower wages. From the OECD Survey of Adult Skills released in 2013, we actually know a lot about our workforce. We know that 1 in 6 adults in America age 16 to 65 have low literacy, and one in three have low numeracy skills. We know that a third of these individuals are under the age of 35, which is pretty astonishing. We know that a third are immigrants. We know that more than half are Black or Hispanic. We know that here's the really interesting piece, right? We know that two-thirds of these folks with these low literacy and numeracy and problem-solving skills, two-thirds are employed, but their earnings are low. And again, perhaps possibly the most troubling piece of this puzzle is that in the United States, young adults' skills are not outpacing older adults' skills and not keeping pace with their international peers. This slide shows that in our competitor countries, the young adults are actually making great skill gains, while in the U.S. and in the U.K., skill attainment is relatively unchanged across the age cohorts. These are the adults of our future and our future workforce, our future parents and citizens. We know that youth and young adults with disabilities face even greater challenges. Here's the thing. We know that 4 out of 5 young people with disabilities say that their primary goal when they leave high school is to go to college. Yet youth with disabilities are far more likely to drop out of high school in far greater numbers. They're less likely to enroll and complete post-secondary education, and they suffer higher rates of unemployment, underemployment, and have greater rates of poverty. WIOA provides a really important opportunity in this space. We're talking about young people and the skills challenge and the skills gap. WIOA places an enormous emphasis on serving students and youth, particularly those with disabilities, as they transition from school to post-school activities, including higher ed and employment. We must do better than this. And with that, Mark, I'll turn it back to you.
Great. Thank you, Michael. You've painted a very compelling context for our work to close the skills gap and prepare an educated and skilled workforce to fill in-demand jobs. This data shows us that low skills and education attainment are holding employees back from advancement, higher wages, and greater opportunities, and that education and training are key to breaking the cycle. Johan, could you speak to how Title II programs emphasize educational attainment as being foundational to the success of the workforce development system?
I'd be happy to do that, Mark. And I'm going to divide my remarks and I'm going to put them in two categories. First, I'll talk briefly about highlight three main WIOA reforms that are actually changing the landscape, not just for the Title II adult education and literacy community, but for the communities supported by the other titles. And then my second set of remarks will actually highlight some of the very, very specific reforms that affect adult education. So starting with the highlights of WIOA reforms that are really changing the landscape, I want to mention three. One is the increased coordination of and between the core programs. And everyone knows by now that WIOA gives a state either unified planning option or a combined state planning option that allows a governor to add partner programs to the core programs authorized by the law. That is a significant change from how business was done in the past. This is not about stapling state plans for the different titles together. This is really about creating a unified talent development strategy for a state. The central theme of career pathways and the requirements for local boards and state boards to create these career pathway programs and systems, I think, is an enormous opportunity to actually facilitate this higher level of coordination between the core and partner programs. So that's big change number one that I wanted to highlight. The second one is a much greater emphasis on accountability and improvements of program outcomes. For those of us who have been in this field for quite some time, there have been conversations about common indicators or common measures for such a long time, and guess what? We always actually introducing a set of shared indicators that touch both upon education outcomes as well as on labor market outcomes. So specifically, the education ones deal with credential attainment and with gains in skills. The labor market ones deal with employment and earnings. The third a main change, I believe, that affects all titles, including Title II, is a commitment to improving training and employment opportunities for individuals with barriers, significant barriers to employment. And I most certainly was delighted to see this type of emphasis in the new law that identifies 13 subpopulations that are considered, including individuals with significant barriers to employment, plus the provision that the state may actually determine which other populations are vulnerable that are not included in that list. Here's the list. It's a long one. People with disabilities is one I just want to highlight. Adults who are English learners, adults with low literacy, ex-offenders, foster youth, an important population. But there are more, as you can see. So these are, even though there are many more reforms that WIO is introducing, these are three that I wanted to highlight. Now, turning to the specific changes in Title II for the Adult Education and Family Literacy Act, I wanted to highlight four. The first one is that Title II really strengthens the alignment between adult education, post-secondary education and training, and the employer community. And I might extend that to saying, you know, it's business, industry, and labor on the private sector side. So what we will see is an increased emphasis on and support for the transition into post-secondary education and training, which is facilitated by this closer alignment with the post-secondary system. It's great that Title II remains some of the other purposes it had, but we're delighted that we're not placing a period after the high school credential. We're actually placing a comma there and allowing people to continue to transition. One other thing that I would like to point out here that deals with alignment is that the providers who are eligible to provide services under Title II have changed. One new comer to the game, so to speak, is the notion of employer partnerships, where employers in partnerships with other eligible providers can apply for the Title II funding once it gets to the state and is competed out. And again, I mentioned the centrality of the career pathways construct throughout the law, which I think will create enormous opportunities for Title II to achieve alignment that it has not achieved before. The second main area of change for Title II deals with supporting new activities, things that the old Workforce Investment Act did not allow people to support, and we are quite excited about this, and I'll highlight three of these new activities. One is the whole idea of integrated education and training. The second one is workforce preparation activities, whether those are workforce preparation activities for immigrant professionals or for others, that is now an opportunity under Title II, which did not exist before. And then thirdly, we are delighted that that the law codified the old English Literacy and Civics program, and it's now called the Integrated English Literacy and Civics Education Program. It's great because now it's no longer dependent on the annual appropriations process. It's actually embedded in the law. So two left. The third main area of change that I wanted to emphasize today is that Title II now encourages investments in correctional education and reentry in ways that we have never seen before. You may recall that under the old law, there was a cap of 10%, and Congress now changed the cap to 20%, meaning that a state can choose to take up to 20% of its resources under Title II and dedicate them to support not only correctional education as we knew it under the old law, but also a range of new activities intended to reduce recidivism. Integrated education and training, peer tutoring within facilities, transition services that are part of reentry, and again, here, career pathways are just examples of that broader range of activities. Lastly, I wanted to highlight a fourth major change. And this one deals with supporting investments in high-quality programs and innovative or promising models. Very happy to see that there is an expectation that all providers under Title II must demonstrate their effectiveness in providing services to older youth and adults, referencing a performance similar to the performance indicators specified in the law. Secondly, I want to point out that states continue to be required to compete the funding once it comes to them by formula, which creates, we think, three major opportunities for the system. One is achieve much greater alignment between what is happening in Title II programs and what regional economic and workforce development needs are. The second one is there is a great opportunity to leverage state procurement processes for this within-state competition to promote integrated education and training programs. And I think it's particularly important to highlight that one because that happens to be the type of promising model for which there is an emerging evidence base. So from that standpoint, I want states to keep in mind that there's a good evidence-based reason for doing that. And then thirdly, again, the state competition requirement under Title II could really help the local boards and the state boards in the building of these career pathway systems. The final opportunity for states when they compete the funding and throughout Title II is the opportunity to use the resources to use technology to personalize learning experiences for adults. Now, there are many more specific changes under Title II that I did not talk about, and there are many more broader WIOA reforms that are changing the landscape, but I chose to highlight these.
Great. Thank you, Johan. I understand these are major reforms for Title II programs and a new way of doing business with new stakeholders. Janet, can you tell us about the changes to Title IV and how they support the importance of educational attainment and employment?
Sure. Thank you, Mark. First of all, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act does make significant changes for the vocational rehabilitation program in multiple areas. And I think that it's important, you know, to recognize even some of the highlights that you're hearing today collectively from everyone really does cross over to our population of individuals that we serve in the vocational rehabilitation program nationally also. So it's always exciting to hear how these other programs interface with our programs now under this new legislation. I think most importantly, I'm going to focus specifically on a couple of areas of note, particularly with regard to individuals who are youth and students who are youth, because they're the population of individuals that the vocational rehabilitation program does provide services, and they're also a population where this specific legislation really does emphasize the need for continued support, transition services, employment services, job training, just as you heard Michael mention earlier, particularly for youth also, because we know that in the disability community that these populations oftentimes do not have the opportunity to experience early work opportunities and to have job training that literally grows with them as they are navigating their way through the educational systems as well. So it's really important to recognize under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act that the vocational rehabilitation community will have the opportunity to be innovative in their approaches and strategies and partnerships to engage youth with disabilities in very different ways than they have been able to do so previously. And some of examples of that include ensuring that individuals who are students or youth who are matriculating through the education system or who are transitioning from the educational system to post-secondary education, that they have the opportunity to engage in work activity while they are attending school, that as they're interfacing with special education, for example, that they will have that opportunity to experience work and that they have the opportunity to have the same experiences that their peers have, most importantly, earlier than what they traditionally have had that opportunity to do so. Equally important in this piece of legislation also is the populations of those individuals with significant disabilities that are being served by the nation's vocational rehabilitation program as well. This provision now allows for extended services, for example, for individuals with significant disabilities. They now have the ability to be served, to have their services extended from 18 to 24 months, and then if they need additional extensions, individuals with significant disabilities will have the opportunity to receive services for up to 4 years. And that's important for this population because we recognize that it's important for them to have the opportunity to move at their pace, but they also oftentimes need additional skills in addition to the traditional skill sets that they may have been working on, such as independent living skills, counseling, certainly mentoring opportunities that they may not have had access to previously. Also, I think another part of this whole change in this legislation for the VR program is focusing on those youth also who become disconnected. Those youth, as Michael referenced earlier in his remarks, who may in fact drop out prior to receiving a degree, they become disconnected. We still have the opportunity to work with those individuals under this piece of legislation. And it's really critical to get to those individuals early on in the process so that they can in fact receive the job training skills that they need. I think additionally that the vocational rehabilitation community, who has always worked with the employment community, the employers themselves, we recognize in this particular program that we have dual customers. All of us, all the core partners have dual customers, and that we are serving individuals with disabilities, but we are also offering and leveraging the support and services to employers as well so that they can, in fact, avail themselves of the resources and leverage the existing expertise that there is in our respective communities of practice in order to meet their needs so that we have a better understanding of what are the employers' needs and how do we best position our programs as well as our consumers to meet their specific needs as well. We want to ensure that our community have the opportunity to understand how to best market their skills, how to best understand where the career paths are going to, making sure that they have access and that they're prepared for career paths such as in the STEM industry, for example, so that they are best positioned to, in fact, be prepared and engage in competitive integrated employment, which is also very much focused on in this piece of legislation as well. We want to ensure that individuals with disabilities have that opportunity and that we are utilizing innovative approaches to ensuring that they have the skill sets and that they are, in fact, prepared and that the agencies are using innovative approaches to working with these individuals so that they can, in fact, help with maximizing the abilities and the skills that individuals will need to, in fact, become productive individuals in the workforce. So those are our some specific highlights, and I think I will close with just emphasizing as well under this piece of legislation that we also have another area that the law impacts for our population of people that we serve, and that is those individuals who are working under the 14C certificates, and that the vocational rehabilitation program is taking a key leadership role in addressing what the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act charges us with doing. And that's ensuring that these individuals, in fact, have the opportunity to engage in work activity that is competitively integrated and that they are best positioned, again, to receive early work experiences and that they can work within the system, the educational system, the vocational rehabilitation system, so that they can, in fact, ensure that we can ensure that they have the training and the skill sets necessary and the opportunity, most importantly, so that they can, in fact, experience competitive integrated employment that will lead them to economic self-sufficiency.
Thank you, Janet. Well, it's clear that there are a variety of opportunities, as well as many challenges to implementation in helping our customers and stakeholders realize their potential. Michael, before we turn to questions, would you like to wrap up our panel as you began it with the big picture? Give us a bookend as to why education is key.
Sure. Thanks, Mark, and thank my colleagues here as well. You know, we know how important education is. We know how important completion is. We know certificates, degrees, credit hours are absolutely critical to successful employment. But learning, educational attainment and learning is more than just that, right? Learning opens opportunities, it opens horizons, it opens dreams, and not just for the individual, but for their families and their communities across the country. You know, we can look at career exploration or work-based experiences. Through these opportunities, whether they're young people or adults, they have the opportunity to explore a wealth of jobs and careers. We know that learning opens worlds of interests and passions and vocations that enrich the human experience. We know that learning promotes confidence and civic engagement, such as involvement in their children's schools, their community, volunteering. This is the glue that makes our communities stronger. Learning promotes social trust and appreciation of human diversity. And ultimately, learning is a strong determinant of health and well-being for adults and their families. So I just wanted to kind of bring us to a really much bigger picture. Obviously, we know how important education is to employment and success in the workforce, but clearly, obviously, a much bigger set of values that we can accomplish here. So thanks for this opportunity. You know, this legislation really does present us the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and this is all about innovation and opportunity, and we stand ready to go.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you to all of our panelists for participating in today's webinar. And now I think, Heidi, it's time for us to take a look at some of the questions that have been coming in.
All right. Thank you for those of you who've been typing your questions into the chat box. I'll read them out so they become part of the audio transcript. And, Mark, you get to decide who answers. How about that?
Okay.
To what do you attribute the great skill gains in the other OECD countries? This was entered while Michael was showing the slides about the OECD results.
This is Johan. I cannot speak for all of the OECD member nations and economies that have made significant progress, but I can only speak to a few where I've actually had the opportunity to read a little bit about what may explain this incredible increase in the skills of their population, and particularly their younger populations. You know, it's clear that nations like Finland, Korea, now also Singapore and others were very, very intentional a couple of decades ago about creating stronger and rigorous opportunities for all of their young people to develop their skills. And I think what we are seeing right now is the payoff to that investment. I'm not a great futurist. I don't have a crystal ball, but I think looking at the work that our administration has done over the last couple of years to make sure that all people have access to rigorous opportunities, I think will show itself in the next assessment of this assessment as well, administration of this assessment as well. Michael?
Yeah, just to add to that, to piggyback on that, you know, we often battle here politically about spending in education, and if you've heard the president or the secretary of education, you know, spending in education is an investment in our future. And too often we say, well, this is too much spending or this is too much money. But we have these battles, right? We have budgetary battles at the state and local level. We know that in education, the primary source of education funding is state and local dollars. They're not federal dollars. So that certainly may explain some of the differences with the United States and these other countries. But as Johan said, you know, for us, you know, we have made significant progress, right? Our graduation rate has never been higher, where we have more kids of color entering and graduating from college than ever before, doubling down our investments in Pell Grants and financial aid and the like. So our kind of laser focus on equity and creating those opportunities so every young person has the opportunity to be successful is critical.
Hey. Thank you, Michael.
All right. The next question is, what are some of the ways that VR agencies will be evaluating the provision, arranging for the coordination, or for all students with disabilities who are potentially eligible?
This is Janet LeBrack, and I think that it will be important for agencies to ensure that their partnerships are strong and that their partnerships that they are working on within their respective states are looking at this issue from, I think, an innovative approach. I think that there should be ongoing discussions and memorandums of understanding that really emphasize the, I think, ability of each partner to contribute in ways that they're going to look at leveraging the existing resources. And I think most importantly, to ensure that you're engaging all partnerships in a way that is going to support what the overall mission is. So I think that it will be really, really important for everyone to have a critical role in identifying those strategies that they are going to use to ensure that they are reaching the various populations that they need to be serving.
Can I just add to that? I'm sorry.
Sure.
You know, just, you know, transition really isn't rocket science, but it's making sure that the right partners are at the table developing the right kinds of plans. What are the supports that the individuals are going to need? WIOA provides a really good opportunity to strengthen and enhance transition services. You know, IDEA, which is the special ed law, requires transition as part of the kids' IEP, Individualized Education Program. It's a part of FAPE, the entitlement to a free, appropriate public education under special ed. WIOA has very complementary provisions of law that really put in place the mechanism at a state and local level for partners to come together to provide those linkages, but to provide those kids and those families with the supports that they need.
And I should also add, in addition to that, in 2014, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program nationally provided services to 65,462 individuals ages 14 to 24. And there was a total of 117,000 or a little bit over that of individuals in the program. And of that, 96% of those individuals achieve competitive integrated employment. So that demonstrates that when we get to these students and to these youth with disabilities early, when we're utilizing innovative approaches and when our partnerships are strong, then we absolutely can address these issues and ensure that these youth are navigating their way through their educational systems and that they have the opportunity to engage in internship opportunities and early work experiences of all kinds to best prepare them for employment success.
Great points and data.
Mm-hmm. All right. Another question here is, what are the common performance measures in WIOA?
So those performance measures are employment in the second quarter, employment in the fourth quarter. I'm looking at my colleagues. Median wages in the second quarter. Measurable skill gains. Earning a credential, a secondary or post-secondary credential, and effectiveness in serving employers.
Thumbs up here.
And
actually, that piggybacks on a question that just came in. It says that you've been talking a lot about college degrees, but what about industry-recognized credentials? You want to say something about that?
There will be some additional guidance coming out where we will bring more definition to what actually all the credentials are, and that particular type of credential will be addressed there as certifications and licenses for particular occupations.
If I may, just for a minute, I want to piggyback because Johan talked a lot about career pathways, and we're talking about industry. I think it's worth noting we collaborated with Octave here in my shop in OSERS around model demonstration projects around career pathways for individuals, for youth with disabilities, individuals with disabilities, recognizing how critically important career pathways can be. So we've awarded grants to four states to really kind of show us the way how we can apply career pathways to youth and individuals with disabilities.
There's another related question that just came in. Can we define measurable skill gain, or is this a time to say what we said at the beginning of the WIOA convening, that the final guidance is not out?
Yeah, I think that's right, Heidi. Our final regs will be available soon, and it'll be clear, and then, of course, we'll follow up with additional guidance as well.
That being said, there is a high-level definition in the statute, you know, and our guidance will just elaborate on that broader definition.
All right. There's a question. What is being used to determine homelessness and low income? This came in back when we were looking at the long list of barriers to employment. That's something we're
Could you repeat the question?
Which data and what measures are being used to determine homelessness and low income? And there was a little bit more question saying some of our students are actually not as low income as the federal guidance, but they're still struggling. And I think we recognize that low wages may be wider than the federal guidance.
I mean, I think we were very appreciative of this question and also some of the comments that we have received through the various public comment processes. And we're taking this under advisement. And, you know, when we get to issuing the performance guidance at some point in the near future, these comments and this question will be addressed directly.
Yep.
All right, and Johan, I think this one is for you. A restatement of which program did you mention that is no longer subject to appropriations under Title II?
So it was the old English Literacy and Civics program under the Workforce Investment Act, which actually was not part of the law. It was an appropriated program every year. So it is now in the new law as an authorized program and with a specific appropriations level, and let me just make sure I don't say the name wrong. It's now called the Integrated English Literacy and Civics Education Program. Mouthful, but that's the new name.
Great. Here's a question in. What options are being offered to students who have dropped out who are seeking industry-specific training? I think several of you mentioned disconnected youth.
Well, I think for the vocational rehabilitation community, there are several options in that the program has historically worked with some of these youth who have been disconnected, and I think that all of our programs actually fall into this category where we all have youth who have become disconnected, whether they're incarcerated or whether they're coming back into the community from pre-release programs, individuals who, in fact, may have been homeless and they're transitioning back into the community or to different communities where they need a variety of support services. We have all had experience with these populations, and I know that in particular for the VR community, we have a National Technical Assistance Center for youth to deal specifically with this, so that we are engaging the National Technical Assistance Center to help with supporting and providing resources and information that really does address these issues so that information can be provided, we can do outreach, we can provide support at the community level for families, for individuals, for school systems where youth may have already become disconnected. We also have another technical assistance center also that deals with transition, and that purpose of that transition center is to also deal with those individuals who have not certainly become disconnected as of yet, but who may in fact be at risk for becoming disconnected, and to provide those supports to educators and certainly I think the professional community, their families, and the VR community itself to really be able to provide supports and information based on research and evidence-based practices that are going to align with providing services and supports to those individuals who may be at risk for becoming disconnected.
This is Portia Wu. I wanted to add to that, with the emphasis in WIOA in the youth formula programs funded through the Department of Labor, there's a real shift to focusing on disconnected youth, saying states have to put 75% of their formula funds to that work, and with 20% of that, 20% of youth funds going towards work-based experiences. So that combined with the measuring credentials, measuring skills gained, I think that all of this is really going to encourage the partnerships, which we've been talking about on this call, both from our side, funded from the Department of Labor, as well as our education partners, to really think together about how do we get disconnected youth connected with those industry-specific oriented training programs that can lead to skilled jobs. So I think that's another one of the great opportunities, and we look forward to partnering with all of you on that.
You know, just building on that, I think also, Portia, the work in the apprenticeship space, I think that is also getting a little bit of a boost through WIOA and through some new investments that Congress has authorized, I think can create some additional.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And also within Title II, you know, I'm not sure if folks are aware of this, but every year between 700,000 and 750,000 disconnected youth younger than 25 reconnect with education through Title II of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. Up until this point in time, we didn't have much to offer beyond the educational experience for them. Now, with the integrated education and training provisions, with the new activities that are allowed, such as workforce preparation activities, we can actually do a lot more. We can also go to our partners in Title I, III, or IV and say, what can we do here?
As well as the combined partners.
Yeah, we can go to Perkins and say, you know, on the CTE side, what can we put together here that has an industry focus, gives people a real credential and good skills, and expand the opportunities that did not exist before for this subpopulation?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to bundle up several other comments that are coming in to engage all of you in the response like we just did on that one. There are several comments about the individuals with limited English or low-skilled in English or the crossover between disability and limited English. What are the opportunities in WIOA to serve these individuals?
So I'll start, but I'll turn it over to Johan. I mean, I think the whole kind of purpose, and I hope we alluded to it early when we kind of started this call, is the vision, right? Like, it shouldn't matter what the barrier is. The individual, you know, whether they have, you know, speak English as their primary language or not, whether they have a disability or not, and many of the folks that come into our workforce development system do have multiple barriers. But the whole point of this is to create this seamless, high quality, and accessible system that meets the needs of the individual, and they very well may have multiple needs. They should be able to come to a one-stop system and get the supports, whether it's English language instruction, whether it's vocational rehabilitation, whether it's other kinds of supports or services. Johan?
You know, one of the things, I mean, being an English learner myself and having been an ESL teacher, I was super excited that one of the populations identified with significant barriers to employment are the limited, are English language learners. You know, so from that standpoint, I think there's lots of opportunity to continue to serve that population. And there's actually an implicit expectation that programs would. I really appreciated Michael's point, you know, so that we don't fall into the trap of compartmentalizing people based on whatever their significant barrier is, but that we would really take this opportunity to work together between the various programs and say, well, do we have data that show, for example, what the incidence of disabilities is in the English learner population, in the foster youth population, in whatever it may be, and that we then come together at the federal, state, and local levels to really figure out a strategy that would leverage the various assets that the programs bring.
That's right. And just because an individual may come in with a disability doesn't mean they need VR services.
Right.
They may need English language instruction and some, you know, job training that they can get, you know, outside of the VR program. So it's really important to not, like, all right, this person has this barrier, so they go into this program. That's not what this is about. That's this is the opportunity to break down those silos and those barriers and really meet the needs of the individual, the needs and the interests of the individual.
And I think that's right. And I think that is really important to understanding also the partnership piece. And that's why I think that this piece of legislation is so important to all of us, because this gives us that opportunity to really leverage the expertise that each one of us as core partners brings to the table to support the community's needs. And I think that the more we do that and the more effective we are at putting those strategies together, the more successful our consumers will be.
That's great. There's another bundle of questions. People are asking about resources, guidance, evidence, models, toolkits, and technical assistance. And there's been some talk sprinkled throughout, but maybe we could bundle your responses up around what the department is doing on that front.
You know, a lot, right? And so we've developed this really robust and I hope mature partnership across our agencies. That's not just, you know, our office, the Office of Special Ed and Rehab Services, but with OCTE and labor and the Administration on Children and Families and food stamps, and really thinking about how we support states and local providers and communities across our programs. So, you know, we jointly work on guidance together. We link to each other's guidances or technical assistance centers. Our program, just to note, and I'll suddenly let Johan or Portia talk about others within their offices, their investments, but we have a really robust technical assistance network. Janet mentioned, you know, a couple of them. We have our transition center and our targeted youth TA center for disconnected youth. But we've invested in job-driven training to help providers understand how to meet the needs of local economy and how to provide those job-driven training opportunities. We've invested, as I said, in career pathways. We're investing in actually technical assistance to support WIOA and the performance requirements of WIOA. So there's a really robust technical assistance network. We have the ION network. Portia, if you're still on, you may want to talk about that. Johan, Portia?
Yes, I was actually just pulling off the website and looking at it right now as you were saying that, Michael. I hope everyone's familiar with the ION Network. That's the Innovation and Opportunity Network. And what we're doing is we're putting our all our webinars that we do. If you miss them, we're putting them up there. We've got a bunch of stuff from the national convening. The website, if people aren't familiar with it, is WIOA.workforce and then the number 3 and then the word 1.org. That's where it is right now. And, you know, there are a bunch of webinars archived there, sort of voices of experience, you know, people talking specifically about some of their things that they've done and their individual programs, serving targeted populations like disconnected youth, for example, working on continuous improvement, customer-centered design. And, you know, if you go on there, these webinars and these all these resources have been viewed thousands of times already. So I think they are useful for people. We encourage you to take a look at those and share your information with us. Many of you may have terrific best practices that we could learn from, so we really want to make sure that we have a robust community of learning here.
And I think it's also important to acknowledge as well that we recognize the individuality of our programs as well, and that we need to support the communities that we all serve, particularly the states, with making sure that they have access to quality technical assistance. And we are planning to do that both in a joint way as well as in a program-specific way so that we can leverage, I think, the issues and concerns of our individual programs as well. Because as we are all core partners, we all still have very different pieces of each one of our programs also that is very specific to our program. So we recognize that and acknowledge that. So we have multiple plans for really providing technical assistance in multiple ways. And we have reached out to folks as part of the convening to say, again, we want to hear from you. What will be helpful to you? What would you like us to do? How will you best benefit? And what will be the most useful for you?
And, Janet, to that point, this is Portia again. I should have mentioned we have some forthcoming guidance soon on that we're going to try to give some guidance on privacy issues in FERPA and wage records and how you crosswalk those. That's one of the questions we get a lot from educational institutions, certainly, as well as from workforce and unemployment insurance folks at the state level. So we know there are some important cross-cutting pieces of guidance, and we're working on those. And the state planning documents, what's going to be required to be reported for state plans, is also out right now. So I encourage everyone to take a look at that.
Yes. And the VR community is also putting out some technical assistance also on in the form of an FAQ for folks with regard to pre-employment transition services and under the provision of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. The VR community has some new provisions that they need to meet. The VR community is now going to be required to set aside 15% of their resources to provide pre-employment transition services to those youth. So that we can, in fact, have a strategy for addressing their barriers to employment and making sure that we're being proactive about providing those services to those individuals. In addition, you know, to some other technical assistance guidance and FAQs that we'll be working on and putting out as well. So folks should be looking for that to be coming as well.
This is Johan, just speaking briefly to the original question. You know, I think it's important to point out two things. One is, just like we have done in any other aspect, relative to any other aspect of the implementation of this law, we have a coordinated approach to technical assistance that is truly an interagency approach. So from that standpoint, it's really important to view the title or program-specific type of technical assistance efforts, not as substitutes or in competition with some of the joint areas of technical assistance that we are leveraging through the newly created network that Portia was talking about, but that we really say, okay, there are different types of technical assistance that are needed. Some of these we are pursuing together because they involve issues that are cross-cutting. Others are really title-specific, and therefore we are choosing sort of program or title-specific vehicles for delivery.
But they should all be accessible, and they should all be complementary.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, there's another subset of questions that's coming in asking about rural states and the unique challenges that rural states and single area states face in IET, in student barriers such as transportation, child care, et cetera. So could you think about responses to folks in rural states?
You know, I'm not a governor, but if I were, I would say that I would, for instance, leverage the provision that a state can identify an additional subpopulation with significant barriers to employment. I mean, that seems to be one opportunity that this new law presents to directly address that specific issue, and there may be others.
I would say that this is, again, a unique opportunity as part of the state planning process. As you're developing those partnerships, I think Johan is correct in that, that's a really good suggestion, because I think, again, this is where the innovation and opportunity, you know, come into play, and in that these are going to be concerns across all of the programs that the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act covers. And so they're going to be issues. Transportation is the number one significant barrier for individuals with disabilities, for going to work, for engaging in their community. And so these are, I think, areas that should be discussed at the local level to ensure that these topics are coming up and to ensure that they are part, you know, of a strategy, a comprehensive strategy to have it addressed at the local level.
Portia, did you want to speak to that one?
No, I think that this issue of planning, you know, is really, really important. You know, there are some questions that have been raised by single area states. Certainly, and we'll be addressing some of that in our regulations as well as our guidance. You know, we did hear those comments, and we understand the concerns. But to echo what the others have said, is focusing on those barriers and figuring out how we can meet them. And I will say also the Department of Labor, we've got some competitive grants out now talking about how you address populations with barriers and get them connected to skilled jobs in technology fields, for example. So we're aligning all of our programs and investments to try to support that work, and not just exactly what's required by the law, but we feel like the law is setting a big picture direction and framework that we should all be supporting with all of our resources. So there are other opportunities for us to partner on those fronts as well.
All right. Thank you. There's another set of questions that's about adults with disabilities. People have been asking about how do we raise the employment rate for adults with disabilities, what's going to make that move. Someone asked about Ticket to Work and how is this coordinated with that. Someone asked about whether any of the WIOA funds would be allowable, if allowable uses of WIOA funds would support medical needs in post-secondary or employment settings. And to start off all of that is, what is the definition of a significant disability?
Janet, do you want to take the...
Well, I think, you know, that one of the strategies that certainly everyone should be using to address, I think, all of those particular areas is really looking at what some of the barriers are. I think that the most important way to reduce barriers and to improve employability, obviously, is education, literacy, making sure that individuals have access and that they, in fact, do not become disconnected. I think in many ways that you've heard today a variety of those topics that we have touched on today, to really to have a better understanding of what some of the barriers are. These are all barriers that we have all seen in the populations that we all serve, and I think that education is critical, making sure that our populations have a clear understanding of what the landscape is of employment today. Where is the market? What kinds of skills? What kinds of career paths and opportunities? I think that earlier individuals have an understanding of what those issues are and how to best access them, and the fact that we can set our policies and address our policies and create strategies and mechanisms to align so that, in fact, our populations can access them, not only access them, but they can use them and become successful. And then I think research is important, because I think that research plays a critical role in understanding what has not worked, what has not been a strategy that has been effective, and how do we best change those strategies, and how do we best change those outcomes, and what are the best models, providing models for states to be able to have a better understanding, providing information and resources in a way that is really going to support both the states as well as the individuals that we serve, I think is going to be critical to addressing some of those issues around employability as well.
Thanks. And Janet, this is Michael. And just, you know, I talked earlier, and folks know, you know, the educational outcomes for individuals with disabilities are lower than the general population. We look at the adult skill levels, and 1 in 6 have very low literacy skills, 1 in 3 have low numeracy skills. For people with disabilities, when they come to a one-stop system, again, it's making sure, first of all, that they're not automatically directed into the VR program because they may or may not be eligible, they may or may not want VR, that just may or may not be the case. But they may need a particular set of education or training opportunities, and we need to make sure that those are accessible. If we're talking about individuals with very low literacy skills, whether they have disabilities or not, you know, giving them a handbook of, you know, 50 pages of text is didn't work then for them when they were in school, and it probably is not going to work now. We really need to think about accessibility and how we're providing our educational and training materials in a format that meets the needs of the individuals we're trying to serve.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we are just about at time. I think we wanted to give Portia a chance to have one last word.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I think the ongoing partnership between Department of Labor and the Department of Education is really critical. It doesn't really matter what door people come into, but they all are seeking the same thing, as my colleagues have said. And really, the footprint of our education partners in terms of training and providing skills and preparing people for the jobs of today and tomorrow is really the biggest footprint. And so we're really excited to continue to work work with you in partnership, please let us know what we can do to be better partners, to be more responsive to you, to make sure that at the state and local level you are having a fruitful conversation and that we are convening expansive tables. So, again, thanks for including us, and keep an eye out for our ongoing resources and technical assistance. We welcome continuing the conversation.
And this is Mark Mitsui. I wanted to thank our panelists very much for engaging with the audience today. Janet Labreck, Michael Uden, and Johan Uven from the Department of Education, and Portia Wu from the Department of Labor. Also wanted to thank Heidi for her assistance, Charles Brown as well. And thank you to all of you who dialed in today and asked some great questions. So we really appreciate, again, you participating in today's webinar and for the work that you do each and every day for our clients, students, and customers. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll be posting the transcripts. We'll be posting the slides, and we'll get a thank you email out with links to all the resources, so you'll be seeing it in email and on our WIOA website. So thank you very much.